This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is the London FinTech Podcast, episode 247. Brought to you in association with Smart and enlistedboard.com. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Rusbir Batcher, founder and CEO of City Falcon, to talk about the marathon approach to achieving success in your tech business. By definition, the LFP and the whole fintech world naturally focuses on what succeeds. And thus there is a huge selection bias which gives the impression that, especially in the super scalable tech world, that the model for success is shoot for the moon. If you get it, great. If you don't, never mind. Start all over again. And that's definitely a model, a very well-known model. However, that model is unrepresentative, firstly, of business as a whole, and secondly, also of many tech businesses. To take an extreme case, we're a great fan of Harvey's Beer, Harvey's being Sussex's largest brewer, formed in 1790, still privately owned today, and five seventh and eighth generation family members still work there, according to their website. And naturally, as one can imagine, in getting on for 250 years of business, there have been all sorts of challenges and ups and downs along the way. Resilience in life, in business, is a major thing. Now, naturally, 1790 founded businesses are atypical even for oldie England. However, I use this to indicate that there is a wide spectrum from insta-coffee, insta-success, insta-failure to persistence over, in this case, centuries. Rusbir is a great person to discuss this topic with, as he was first on the LFP over 8 years ago, talking about the reality versus hype in UK startups, and last on, 5 years ago, talking about the reality of being an entrepreneur. In both episodes, he epitomised a commitment, which definitely pleases me, to telling it like it is, warts and all, which is pretty rare in the all-too-hypey, a modern world of tech. In prepping for this show, I was also much taken by the interaction of morality with the timescale element, one I hadn't immediately noticed. In times like these, hat tip to Foo Fighters fans there, when we need a resurgence of real morality more than ever, especially perhaps in the areas of business and FS, this is one angle, amongst many, not to be neglected. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Good morning, Rusbir. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Mike. A pleasure to be back again.
We thought in terms of talking about a fresh topic to kick off the show that we might talk about the fact that since you were last on the show, you are what, laughingly in the old days, we used to call Maltesers, by which I mean you haven't turned into that honeycombed sugary sweet, but you are living in a small to medium-sized island in the Mediterranean.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Malta is the new home for me, so I keep coming back to London for work, but the sun, the sea, and the emerging technology and fintech scene in Malta is quite exciting.
And so did you get there pre-pandemic, pre-Brexit? As we were talking about beforehand, Bridget and my plan were to semi-immigrate to Portugal, which was looking good in December. But then at the end of December, they ended something called the NHR, where favourable taxation for 10 years after moving to Portugal, whether it's you're a 20-year-old Portuguese who's coming back from university or whether you're a retiree or semi-retiree, that was suddenly abolished and it's all too easy to end up paying 48% tax in Portugal. And as I've mentioned on podcast before in passing, there is a remarkably short list, and I say short list, I'm not even sure there's one, and if it was one, is one a list of countries which in the current situation, British people, someone with a British passport can actually go to. So how did you manage to get to Malta and when did you do it?
So post-Brexit, which obviously wasn't good for any of us when you're running a business, we were looking for places to move to. And we thought about Estonia, we thought about Portugal, Ireland. But Malta was interesting for a few different reasons. One is, obviously, we don't want to bear the winter in Estonia, which I've bared in the past. So Malta was exciting. We went there. We spoke to the Maltese government. There is Malta Enterprise, which was really supportive. And in about a couple of months, we had a letter of intent with the grant from the government. And since then, Malta Enterprise has been supporting us. By the way, if anyone is running a business and wants to open another center in the EU, especially if you're in the UK. You can go to Start in Malta, and they have a lot of promotional schemes and grants and loans for startups, which actually, they actually give you cash compared to just, hey, advice and office and electricity, which is great.
Yes, that's interesting. Well, let's not get sucked down the very stale now, Brexit or not Brexit. I think I, like most sensible people, have the view that it would have been better either to not Brexit or to actually Brexit, which means lessening minor matters like MiFID II, and it's 10 times the length of the Bible on one tiny section of FS. So neither has happened, and all that's practically really happened is that I can't go anywhere. But in terms of Malta, you mentioned Malta and Estonia, and certainly it does sound like a cliche, but we are perhaps cliches. One of the main reasons for emigrating has been the weather. You know, we've done enough decades of this bloody weather. It's a very manky March morning as we're speaking here. And I do like the Baltic republics, but the weather isn't a lot better in the winter there. And based on my limited experience, the Mediterranean is nicer. So you tick the box of not living somewhere that has poor weather. But more practically than that, I was very interested when we're doing the prep call about your description. I mean, it simply wasn't propaganda, it was a simple description of how positive the Malta government is in terms of creating an environment for business. And regardless of Brexit or not, lots of stuff has happened since Brexit of significant importance. It's true to say that I know of quite a few entrepreneurs that are leaving this country, which they see as ever massively regulated, ever more highly taxed, and ever more enthusiastic about agendas 2030s and taxes and all that. I saw some stats the other day about tax on beer, for example, talking of beer in the introduction, being 10 times what it is on a pint of beer than it is in Germany. And when we came back from Malaysia last year, petrol, which as far as I understand is a bit of an international commodity these days, caught on around the world, is 5 times cheaper in Malaysia. So there is actually, at the moment, just in terms of people I know, there is quite a, not perhaps brain drain, but definitely an entrepreneur drain from this country going elsewhere. And it's interesting that smaller nations in those circumstances, who do create a positive environment, whatever that might mean, for entrepreneurial activity, can really benefit. And just before Christmas, we had a podcast on LFP Saudi Arabia, which was very interesting insofar as they are taking the opposite approach to what happened in Britain, which is in Britain it just sort of happened and Zopa formed and nobody cared, etc., 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 in a very Englishy way. But Saudi Arabia has got a much more centrally planned system. But I won't go so far as to compare it to Singapore. I don't know enough detail of that. But if you do central planning really well, like Singapore or like Saudi to this point, by the sound of it, then actually you can make a lot happen really well. You just don't want to be caught between two stools, which is where we are here. So maybe you'd just like to explain a little bit more. I mean, you mentioned that you were given cash. I quite like that, actually. I think most of the audience will. So if you just go to Malta, do you get given cash for as a reward for going there?
I mean, it's a little bit more complicated
is
than
it?
That.
Oh, that's a pity.
Yes, but what I meant was while we look at other countries and other schemes for entrepreneurs, it's always about non-cash benefits, which doesn't really always help. It's helpful, but not to the same extent. We need to pay salaries. And this is where Malta came in, wherein they subsidize, you know, some of our costs. It's not upfront. We have to spend it first and then claim it from the government. But it's a process, and it works. So that's why we did it. And Malta as an island is now focusing a lot more on fintech and other emerging technologies or innovative technologies with AI and everything else.
It's an interesting point because it occurs to me that wherever you go, there are digital nomads these days. Everybody knows the phrase. Whichever country you go to, you'll find some co-working space. There was co-working spaces in the centre of Penang. There were co-working spaces in Hanoi. You name it, there were co-working spaces. But coming back to this point that the economic environment is always changing in every country, and some countries are becoming less attractive to entrepreneurs who are getting up and going. And as we heard in LFP on France and LFP on Germany, whilst those two countries have their advantages, they also have their disadvantages. And both the French guest and the German guest were talking about the fact that really you want to have found your company elsewhere. So in this situation that I see as sort of eurosclerosis caused by just infinite regulation, as a sort of just a little simple caricature, it's one of the factors amongst many. Then you mentioned Estonia. Estonia was obviously very well known in the early days of the tech boom, with Skype and all that kind of stuff, but they're very pro-business policies. Also relates to things like education system. If you go between Bridget's and mine, four children between us. I don't think you're going to find anybody who isn't sort of pretty left of centre and being told business is bad and capitalism is bad for decades and decades and decades. So I think it seems to me that done well, there's a real opportunity around the world, not just in Europe, but there's a real opportunity around the world, and obviously having somewhere that's, is it EEA or EU? You can tell me. There's a real opportunity to go one level above digital nomads and go, okay, we want to attract businesses.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what Malta is doing, looking at businesses, trying to create more employment, trying to bring a lot of smart people onto the island. 300 days of sunshine works really well with most people.
You make me think of rebranding this as the sort of Malta FinTech podcast.
Yes, yes, yes.
Some advantages. Okay, so look, very interesting there, and one example, but also the generic example that these days everybody is more mobile, perhaps other than people with British passports, but talent entrepreneurs are very good at finding way around obstacles and making things happen. So the competition is on. So maybe you'd like to just give a little brief summary of your background, how you got into tech, fintech, that kind of stuff, and then we can go into the main course, which is a sort of more business one in general, or tech one in general, about the sort of slower, steadier growth path.
Sounds good. So I started off my journey as a qualified accountant with KPMG. Really didn't really enjoy the work, so I, doing a few years of auditing and stuff, did my MBA from Oxford, and then worked for amazing companies like Nokia, which used to be amazing, and then got into Skype, which was acquired by Microsoft, which made me more confident about working with technology products and also helped me be a little bit more financially independent because I had a few stock options in, and Microsoft is a great paymaster, so I worked there for a couple of years. And then when I left those jobs, I wanted to be in fintech, I wanted to be in technology. So the first thing I did is I learned how to code. So I spent 3 months doing that. And while I was doing that, I found this problem for myself, which was I'm trading, investing in the stock markets, and I don't have access to enough information. So this is why I built kind of a version that helped myself. It was a dashboard using Twitter's API, and it worked with the support of some ex-Skypers, raised my first seed round, and that's where I kind of started the company from. So I left my job at Skype in 2013, and by the end of the year, so I started the prototype kind of December 2013, so it's been more than 10 years now, and incorporated the company in June 2014.
Yes, I think you were the first person I formally met that had sort of fintech as a label, insofar as actually I was doing something for a company that was a tech fintech, a chap that had worked for me. I was interim CMO, I think, at the time when we met. But they didn't know they were a fintech because they didn't know the word. But actually, you're the first person who actually, I think, used the word fintech. So let's just take two data points and we can connect them. So at that point in time, you had a B2C product for people who wanted trading information based on information source on Twitter. 10 years later, where is your product now? And then we can sort of join the dots in the middle. What was the original intent, going back to fast growth? Because I assume, a bit like wanting to win the lottery or wanting to be given free cash, most people, to be blunt, prefer rapid success, rapid and massive success. why wouldn't we kind of stuff? So it's not like you on day one said, oh, I want a slow and steady success. No, you must have been aiming at something. What was the original vision at that point?
I thought I would be clear on whether this is successful or not within 5 years of starting to run the company. And that's mainly because what I heard from the other experts who've kind of either done it before, advisors. But our product has changed completely. So we started off looking at B2C, but then I remember a couple of years later, BNP Paribas came to us and said, hey, do you have an API? And I went back to my team and said, why not? And today, 95% of our revenue comes from the API. So we kind of focused on the B2B, B2B2C. We had a lot of challenges, and there were a lot of times where I had to ask myself, should I continue or go back to a, you know, well-paying, fewer number of hours job in the corporate world. But we went through that. But the idea, what you said earlier was, if we keep ourselves alive, and if as long as there is a market for our products, we should keep going. There's no point failing because we've built all this value. And thankfully, this happened. I was struggling with money, and we had eToro coming to us, one of the leading platforms. We worked with them. They saw really good engagement with our product, and they took a stake in our company. And so that kind of helped us over a period of time. So today we are a team of 48 people. We've got offices in 3 countries. Yeah, and great to be still alive and working.
So that the original thing is like perhaps all businesses, almost all fintechs, in that there's some minor or major pivoting required along the way. And I think here of gardening, talking about Bridget, my partner, she's a big gardener, and says, oh, let's plant these over here. Okay, I don't get involved. Anyway, so she plants them over there, and then over there, and oh, they didn't grow. Oh, well. Oh, but look, actually, they were growing really well over there, and actually, I've got a new idea. And so it's really a question of trying to find ideas and seeds of ideas that will flourish in the environment in which you put those seeds. So some time is taken in terms of pivoting, finding product market fit. Now, one of the interesting things that you were mentioning before is that there's something really implicit in the fail fast or succeed fast model that I hadn't particularly spotted, that I called ethical or moral or some word like that.
Yeah, I was a believer of fail fast when I started my journey as an entrepreneur. But having gone through, when you put in a lot, you know, your days and nights into a product, you're building a lot, not only the product, but the processing, investing in people. And failing fast, I ask myself, but why do I need to fail? I mean, most ideas, I think, fail too fast because of looking for this product market fit, because without that, you cannot go to the VCs and raise Series A funding. But if you give yourself enough time, if you have the time to listen to your customers, maybe it helps you understand, refine your product, pivot. And this is what I kept telling myself. Like, when is it that I should fail or I consider a failure? And that shouldn't be because the product was not ready, or the product was not good enough, or there's not enough cash flow. It has to be when I don't see a market for my product. When I see there is no potential, customers don't want it. That's the time I pack my bags. And we've seen actually in our journey that the challenge we have is clients ask for more and more. And this is why we've kind of expanded the team, we've raised more funding, and we're going on.
So I'm just thinking about why businesses fail in the technology sector. A lot of them, and I can think of some examples, fail because they try and do a round and they don't succeed in doing a round or even a down round. So there is no money and the lights go out, the computer screen goes off, and then there is no alternative to closing the business. So one of the things which is clearly very critical to the more marathon journey is being able to keep raising money. So how would you see that, not least of which, because given the lifetime of VC funds, many/most VCs want either heaven or hell in their investments. They don't want to buy Harvey's Brewery in 1790 and wait 250 years to get their beer. So is there an angle here about the slower, steadier jog as opposed to fast sprint makes it more challenging as time goes by to raise the funds, having said that presumably it's not having any money to turn the lights on that's the problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our aim has never been to, you know, continuously fundraise and become a unicorn because we raised $300 million. It was always trying to get to cash flow positive. However, we faced challenges which required funding. So Brexit happened, the pound falls 30%, you know, my cost goes up 30%. I have to work through that. COVID happens and the whole sales pipeline disappears, or we go into recession where, you know, suddenly crypto market dies and, you know, clients cannot pay us enough money. So we had these challenges. And thankfully, we have the support of our investors. So we've raised, you know, £5 million over 10 years, bigger rounds in recent times as we got corporate investors in. But fundraising still remains very difficult. And if I have to look back and to be honest with myself, I have been very lucky to have people, meeting the right people, putting ourselves out there, getting their investment. I'm really thankful to seeders, actually, that have helped us a lot, not only from getting money from their investor base, but also putting us out there. So more and more people knew about us, reached out to us, and helped us with the funding.
Yes, it's an important point that VCs also make. VCs, if you speak to VCs, will definitely say, look, these aren't the only type of good businesses out there. This is the subcategory of good businesses out there that, given the premises within which we're working, it makes sense to invest. You can have bloody brilliant business that'll take 25 years to get going, but it just doesn't fit our funds. So it is important to see it from that angle. Now, the longer your journey, the older you get in life, the more likely you are to meet outlier experiences, dislocation, disruption. I think everybody listening to the podcast was, I'm sure, 17 years old at some point, and nothing could go wrong, and they knew everything. Well, many people would have felt that. And then 27, 37, 47. No one gets to 97 and goes, oh, that was a piece of piss, that life thing. It's so easy. No, it's like, oh, well, this happened and that happened. And just a small anecdote. On holiday, we got speaking to some people from a country I won't mention, and we were just chatting about stuff. And then bumped into the same people the day after. And I said, oh, so what do you do? And this couple, they were the world's largest miner of a certain precious gem at one point in their career, and they were in their 70s, say. And they've been working for over 50 years on their business, so it's a very, very long haul. And so just, you know, that sounds fascinating, and asking them about their journey and their process and that. And dislocations, going back to the more decades you live, your more dislocation it's going to be, health or COVID or whatever. And they said, well, the biggest challenge for them was when this precious gem, the country they were in had the largest supply in the world, and they were the largest supplier within that country, about to list on the stock exchange. And then, literally, you open your newspaper and go, oh, shit, massive vein has been discovered in another country, which swamps your country. And that definitely spoils your whole day and spoils your day for several years later. So they had to cope with that challenge, which in their case they did, by moving up the value chain and producing sort of jewelries and other. But anyway, huge, 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 huge challenges they had. So how have you experienced this thing that mixing my metaphors completely as usual? If you're sailing a yacht across the Pacific, you're exposed to quite a lot of weather. You're going to get sort of some freaky weather that you probably don't get sailing from here to the Channel Islands.
Yeah, I mean, disruption, definitely, especially when you're in technology. So to give an example, when ChatGPT was launched last year, I couldn't sleep for 3 nights. I asked myself, is City Falcon really required? You know, I've done whatever, 8-9 years of work. Is it all gone to waste? Has it all gone to waste? And it took me a little bit of time to realize that maybe this is actually not bad for us. This disruption is good as long as you adapt yourself. And we had to adapt ourselves, adapt our products. We were working on things which we said, okay, this is probably no longer relevant. We shouldn't spend more time on it, you know, put it on the back burner and then focus on newer things using better technology. And to be honest, I mean, we discussed in the team, it would have taken me much less time had I got ChatGPT and generative AI back in 2014 when I started. But that's the case as, you know, technology and innovation happens. So this risk of disruption is something that all of us need to be aware of as entrepreneurs. And it's even becoming difficult now as an entrepreneur coming in, or even for us, because there's a lot that's unknown. You know, OpenAI is a private company. There's a lot happening at the big tech when it comes to tech disruption. And it's affecting, as we know, all sectors, like nothing's unaffected. And so your product may be relevant now, may be relevant for the next 5 years, but beyond that may not be. So those challenges, those risks are there, which is why I would think less people would now jump into this, you know, tech scalable businesses because it may not be sustainable over a period of time. Another example I can talk about is when I started the business, as I mentioned, I started with the Twitter's API. And, you know, we built all the product, we invested a lot of money. And we were using the enterprise subscription model, which is where we pay them for every tweet that we access. So it started off with a really low, affordable amount as an early stage company. Then that price kept going up, and then when Elon Musk came in, it was the disruption was incredible. No one expected this to happen. Twitter being a entrepreneur, startup friendly company to becoming primarily focused on cost cutting, you know, profitability and all of those things. So one day we get an email from the team at Twitter saying, your cost is now up 7x, your monthly cost. And wait for it, which was incredible, and we're going to give you less compared to what we were giving you last month. And this we didn't expect, you know, and we had to remove tweets from our product, which was quite painful for me personally, because that's how I kind of started the company. And that affected, and that in a way also affected the valuation in our previous round. So we had to do a last round funding at a 40 to 50% reduction in our share price. Not only because of the external factors, but also these factors that have been affecting our business.
Yes, you remind me of Jordan Peterson back in the day when he just was a lecturer talking about moving it into the unknown, which I talked about quite a lot in the New Year podcast this year, and saying that, you know, the waters of chaos suddenly surround you and you're just floating, you lose all your orientation. And the chaos there is that you've lived in a certain, in your mind, vision, if you like. You've lived in a certain building in your head or in the unseen realms. You've created this vision. And a bit like the precious gem miner, there was a certain worldview he'd had for a long time. And then suddenly that's just wiped away. It's like suddenly somebody dies or gets killed or you get divorced or all that you knew can just disappear. So like many things about the entrepreneurial journey, I think that it's as much as anything else a psychological challenge. It's a human challenge. You know, how do you cope when shit happens? And you mentioned one or two examples of shit happening there. So, yes, the longer you hang out across the oceans without making it to a harbour, whatever the harbour might be, whether it's, as you say, profitability, whether it's exits, or whether it's just an ongoing journey like Harvey's and you expect your seventh and eighth generation descendants in 250 years to be coping with things, is an open question for the founder. And you mentioning Elon Musk, perhaps you weren't his greatest fan as he made your life a misery, but I quite liked his one recently. I saw one of his tweets where he's launched this, as you know, of course, lawsuit against OpenAI. And one of his tweets, he's Mr. Meme, he really is. He said, oh, I'll close my lawsuit as long as you change the company's name to Closed AI, talking of your friends at Microsoft, which was brilliant, actually. Anyway, everyone needs a hobby, even the richest man in the world. That and trying to, as he puts it, single-handedly stop the entire collapse of Western civilization. Minor matters. But anyway, talking about important matters, I mentioned morality, ethics, and other kind of strange words. And when we were talking before, as I mentioned, that you pointed out that there's something implicit in fail fast that has an ethical angle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we talk about entrepreneurship and success, it's all about how many X return did you get or who did you exit to. But I think the human angle here is that by raising money, by launching a business, you're also supporting a lot of people. You're creating jobs, you're supporting their families. And luckily for me personally, the team has been extremely loyal. We have people who worked with me for 7, 8, 9 years. We've got very low turnover. People are happy. I mean, we give the team complete flexibility in terms of what hours they want to work, where they want to work from. And I think this kind of helps. Now, if I were to do a fail fast, I build something, it doesn't work. I have 48 people out of jobs, their family struggling. They need to find jobs. They need to restart everything that they did. And I find this very difficult to do as an entrepreneur. I have done the tough things like letting go of people in bad times or letting go of people who are not competent enough to work in the team, but I cannot penalize the people who've been loyal, who've been working hard. And this is an angle I think a lot of times is not considered in the decision making when people talk about failing. For me, we've created a lot of value over a period of time and we've stayed lean. We haven't raised crazy amount of money. We haven't pushed our valuation to crazy amounts. So if we manage to get even limited success, it could mean a lot in terms of preserving those jobs. It could mean that some of these stock options that the employees have could be worth something and their life is not disrupted.
Yes, I mean, there's two clear business models. The, let's just call it neoliberal one, of the world of human resources, where human beings are resources and you hire and fire them. And there's an implicit assumption in that, that you're dealing in a perfectly liquid marketplace. So you fire them today, they get another job tomorrow, they don't care, which is seen quite a lot in the tech scene and the modern world. And then there's, as I mentioned once or twice before, there's a model which lasted more for centuries, certainly in this country, in that in the 70s or in the 80s, even when I got involved in the stock market, English companies would rather see their profits go down than fire people because it was a community. As I've said many times, the word company originally, Russ, Bear, Mike and Bob and Jack and Jill in company are going to do this. And in the un-neoliberal world, where social relations are perhaps the prime thing, relationship, intimate relationship, family, city, region, nation, there's a hierarchy that everybody's embedded in these social relations. In that world, I don't wish to sound cruel about this because I don't imply the opposite, but it's almost want to say the less sociopathic individual will put a higher priority on rewarding the loyalty of his people and not sacking them tomorrow when he knows they've got 3 kids at school or something like that and their mother's ill or whatever. Oh, you're fired. Go and get another job, you know, or from some, you know, bullshit spreadsheet-y reason. So I think that's a very interesting point. And as I say, I mean, despite having read more than enough tech press over the last 10 years, it's not one that one really sees emphasized. It just comes from this neoliberal, left-brained, heartless kind of, well, this is the efficient thing, I'll fail fast. But as you say, when you've had people who've been loyal to you for 7, 8, 9 years, then there is a social cost to that. So I thank you for bringing that one to my attention, because that one had passed me by. Okay, so look, we've touched on a number of things here. Would you like to try and do the impossible, which is pull together the last 10 years of business and this kind of model, and really sort of sum up for the listeners this whole sort of slow and steady growth model?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, slow and steady was not something that I intended when I started off the business, but the progress that we saw over a period of time, the external factors, the internal factors affecting the business, it just made it look like, you know, it's going to be slower, which is fine. We don't, as a team, we don't give up. I like to hire people who play sports, because this builds this kind of resilience in you, saying, hey, you're not going to fail over a period of time. What we've also seen is, what I have seen, you know, being at level 39 and other places, a lot of companies have failed. And I think it's usually put in two buckets. You raise a lot of money and you're successful, or you raise a lot of money and then you completely lose and then TechCrunch goes after you and all the media goes after you, or you, no one hears about you. You try to build something and fail. But there's a small percentage of companies, I don't know, maybe 5%, 10%, that'll still continue. I do know a lot of entrepreneurs who's still working, you know, who's still trying to make the dream come true, even if they don't have a VC funding or big money. So I think, looking back at last 10 years, and I have to be honest, I have considered saying, should I be doing this? And every time I just sleep over and like, yes, this is what I want to do. I want to continue building this company and fulfilling my dream. But it's not easy for everyone to do that. I think one of the advantages that we've had is, as a team, we have been very lean. We have looked at every expense. Now, what that does is, one, it gives confidence to investors that you're not just going to burn cash for the sake of it. And the second thing is, it allows you to go on for much longer. So when we track our runway pretty much, if not on a weekly, on a daily basis or a monthly basis, we're looking at how long the company is going to survive and if we need to make changes. To give an example, recently we realized that as the team has grown, you know, having a cap table in a SaaS platform, it's becoming too expensive. And so we might have to go back to using Excel for it, but that saves, you know, decent amount of money for us. And so by staying lean and the team kind of challenging every expense, the team supporting in terms of, you know, people are not asking for crazy salary jumps, as, you know, as we've seen pre-COVID, all of those things have meant that if we keep ourselves alive, we keep ourselves in business, things might happen. These unknowns which I talked about could be disruptive, but it could be the other way. Some unknowns that could actually benefit, you know, some tailwind to kind of push you forward. So we are here, we've pivoted, we've done a lot of fundraisers, and our hope is that everything that we've learned, we are building even better products now going forward. So yeah, we'll see how, whether, you know, I hope that we are still here for the next 20, 30 years.
Excellent. So before I wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all you listeners out there, my brand partners for the podcast. Smart is transforming pensions and retirement worldwide. The leading edge retirement tech platform that propelled them success in the UK. Now they're operating on 4 continents and working with partners like Zurich and JP Morgan. Find out more at www.smart.co. Then listedboard.com, your guide to entrepreneurial governance and how you can start making your board an engine of growth today. And I was just thinking, before you let the listeners know more about City Falcon, that it is very good for people to have a choice, although not too much choice, because too much choice means you spend so long on Amazon deciding which pencil sharpener to buy and things like that. But people to have a choice as to whether they want to work for an aggressive neoliberal hire fire company on that journey, or whether they prefer to join a company and remain in company with social relations and people who they see as a sort of kind of second family in a sense, going back to the Harveys and the family business over time. And Climeworks was very much a family business still 200 years after it had founded, and there are advantages of that and there are disadvantages of that. The advantage is that you get the sense that the company actually cares for you and cares about you, and there are plenty of people in the modern world that would like to be somewhere where people care rather than just a number on a spreadsheet. And perhaps in terms of evolution, how the world's going, we're either going to see a bifurcation into this sort of ultra-neoliberalism, neocon war machine-y stuff, and the more human one, or maybe, and both, it is part of the cycle. And at this stage in the cycle, where funding's harder to come by and all that kind of stuff, people will put more of a premium on working for companies such as yours and the other 5 to 10% that do their damnedest to actually try and keep those jobs rather than, oh, how can I be a unicorn? But anyway, so maybe you'd tell us a little bit more about City Falcon, Rusbert, and in particular where you are, who you're serving, where you're going, and what you need more of tomorrow to make you even bigger and better than you are today.
Sure. City Falcon started, you know, as an aggregator of financial content. We use machine learning, we use AI to curate that content. We serve it to our clients. Our clients are BNP Paribas Wealth Management, eToro, Shares in the UK, Plum, a lot of brokers, wealth managers, anyone needing content, whether it's for stocks, private companies, or sectors. But at this point, what we've done is, having spent these 10 years in the industry talking to clients, you know, competitors, partners, all of that, we realize there's a massive gap in the market for clear sector classification. So most sector classifications do not consider AI as a sector today. Forget looking at generative AI and deeper. So what we've done is we've launched DCSC.AI, which is Dynamic Company Sector Classification, which essentially uses machine learning AI to identify new and emerging sectors. We've created a proprietary hierarchy of sectors. So AI would include generative AI, deep learning, all of that. And then everything has a relevant score. So if I look at Amazon, which is a massive company, how much of what they do is relevant to, you know, streaming, e-commerce, other things, you know, cloud, for example. So we understand from looking at their news content, we're looking at how the company describes and their segmental reporting. So with all of this now, imagine the use cases. We think AI is taking over, and we want our portfolio, stock portfolio, to have exposure to AI. So we can help you build a smart portfolio of 1,500 plus sectors. So you can say, I want to invest in generative AI, biotech, something else, and we can give you a list of companies. If you already have a portfolio, we can create a classification for you to understand which sectors are covered, which are not, risk management, all of that. So we're really excited with this product, DCSE. It's filling up a market gap, which has not been affected. And yeah, so our hope is really that this product will take us to being a cash flow positive company. That's our focus at this point.
Well, that's very interesting, and I quite like that idea. I mean, obviously, it's all about information and data and these things. And back in the day, talking about the 1980s, you would get research reports from stockbrokers, and they would have a research report on the mining sector or oil and gas or financial services. Nothing wrong with that, but one reason that they did that was that there was no ability to really do it any other way. But things persist, but these sectors still exist in the stock market and all that. And as we've seen, active equity investors generally underperform the markets. Well, if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. And for anybody, whether it's an individual, whether it's a fund manager or a company trying to outperform the market these days, well, the one thing you can start by doing is looking at the world in a different way from everyone else. Having been somebody who outperformed the market, I outperformed the markets in large part because I saw the world differently. If you see the world the same as everyone else, you're the herd. You're just going to go up and down with the market. So I very much like the fact that you're leveraging tools now with DCSC.AI to be able to look at the world in not just a real-time data sense, but a real-time categorization sense. And I quite like the idea myself. I prepared my own SIP, if I'd had something like this a year ago, to increase the exposure to, say, generative AI, which is just impossible to do any other way. And I like the way that you're slicing and dicing, saying, oh, well, actually, I can do this for you in biotech and all that. So that seems very exciting, and I might even have a look at DCSC.AI myself. So thank you very much for that, Rusbert. I also like to thank you for your honesty over the past decade on your now third appearance of the show, which is a very rara avis indeed. In terms of talking about the world as it is, which, as always, brings to the surface some matters which were rather hidden in the official narrative, which is always going to be the case, no matter what the official narrative is. And I don't know what the future will hold, but I do hope that my grandchildren end up living in a world where they work with people who care about them, and it's a community as much as something trying to enrich some abstract shareholder in some abstract pension fund in the distance. Nothing wrong with that model, and that model should contest as well. But I think there's definitely a place for real ethical and moral investment beyond, as Mr. Musk says, given we've been talking about him, ESG, BlackRock's rules, which he called the sperm of the devil or something like that. But anyway, thank you very much for that, and may I wish you continued success and your descendants continued success for the next 250 years, if not longer.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you're in need of a non-executive or advisory director with deep expertise, experience, and contacts in the worlds of both traditional FS and fintech, or unique insight into how to make your board an engine of growth today, contact me at mike@mikeballyman.com. If you just need one-off advice in these areas, via clarity.fm/mikeballyman.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance with me.